Thank you very much for that introduction, and thank you for coming tonight. I almost taught here at Winnipeg. In 1998, I delivered a series of lectures at the University of Winnipeg at the Faculty of Theology, and they had an opening and wanted to hire me. I was going to come, but they took too long. They had to interview other people. They had other things, requirements the Canadian government put on them. And in the meantime, Baylor University offered me a university professorship. And because it was also in the United States, and because I had two young sons who had never been ice hockey players, but had played a lot of baseball, and because I realized being in Winnipeg in March that it was awfully cold. Anyway, it's interesting to come back. And I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank the Independent Jewish Voices and others who have sponsored my Canadian tour. I have two more stops after tonight. And I'm making this tour for really only one reason, and it's maybe fitting, or in different ways, to announce that in the church. Since the church persecuted Jews for roughly 1,500 years. Although I had a debate once in Scotland with the dean of Yale Divinity, when I said 1,500 years, he said, "Mark, that's an exaggeration, it's only 1,000. So I said, "Well, okay, or 1,000 years." He said, no, you're probably right, 1,500. I said, "I'm sticking with 1,000 years. Is that long enough?" So I like announcing it in the church, the reason for my tour. And it's very simple, to demonstrate that the prophetic voice will never die, that the Jewish prophetic voice will never die. And I have met on this tour young Jews who embody that voice. And so another generation is already coming into being. And of course, that voice today is about the question of Israel and the Palestinians. It's a political question, but it's actually much deeper than that. It's about the prophetic voice. It's about what does it mean to be Jewish. And in each generation, there's new challenges. And our challenge is clear. Today we have Israel permanently oppressing another people. And there are many ways to look at the question, and often Jews talk around it, and around it, and circle it, around it, circle it, and exclamation marks, question marks, start talking about Syria, or something, you know. But I want to say it really clearly as we start. What we as Jews have done to the Palestinian people is wrong. What we as Jews are doing to the Palestinian people today is wrong. That's the confession I've been making since 1988. And I bring it into every talk I have, even when it's on the question of Israel and Palestine. So I would like to share with you some PowerPoint slides with some commentary to show some of the dimensions both of the context that we're living in as Jews with others, and how the Jewish prophetic voice addresses this question. So we start with our introductory slide. Interesting, I have ideas about slides, but I don't do them. I'm a little bit past the computer age. But my assistant in the Center for Jewish Studies at Baylor, who's Polish, just from Poland, helped me with this, and she is learning in the Holocaust class about the 3 million Jews who were killed in Poland. She knew it. She knew Jews had died there, but never really studied it, and never really had to think about it, and she's thinking about it with me, which is interesting. But here, the slide is of the Western Wailing Wall of the temple, right, with religious Jews. And you'll see. But coming out of that wall is of the wall being built around the Palestinians. And on the side, in the background there, is a Torah scroll with helicopter gunships coming out of it. Now, I want to make it clear. There are reasons that some Jews, or many Jews, support Israel. Comes from our weakness in Europe, comes from the Holocaust. And there are many Jews who believe that we have to be protected by the power and helicopter gunships. I understand that, but they should say it. And they should admit what it is. Not say we shouldn't have this map, or we should only have the Western Wall, but admit what we have. Well, this is a book that David talked about a little bit, Toward a Jewish Theology of Liberation. It's the third edition. I wrote the first edition in 1987. The second edition, after the Palestinian Uprising, with a new chapter titled The Palestinian Uprising and the Future of the Jewish People. And this is the third edition, published in 2004, which includes the book after Toward a Jewish Theology of Liberation, which was titled Beyond Innocence and Redemption, Confronting the Holocaust and Israeli Power. Don't worry, it didn't sell at all. It was published in 1990 by Harper, a pretty big publisher, and no one would put it in their bookstores because that title was blasphemous. And so is that one. Now, I've been going in a lot of airports in Canada, and I keep looking in bookstores. I go in each one and see if my book is there. It's not there. And there are some magazines that will not take paid advertisements for the book because the title itself is considered blasphemous. But let's unpack the title. There's no rabbi, I want to say there's no rabbi, you may be able to correct me, but there shouldn't be a rabbi in the world that says Judaism equals Israel. It doesn't matter, they may support Israel completely, but there shouldn't be a rabbi that says Judaism equals Israel, or Israel is Judaism, right? And I was just asked to write a book in a series, a Does Not Equal series. Why? The Vatican does not equal Catholicism. Islam does not equal fundamentalism. Evangelical Christian does not equal Republican. Well, let me take a moment, and I have to, just please forgive me. Since we got rid of George Bush, you seem to have taken up the standard, the flag of evangelical Christianity. I understand your prime minister is very close to that. And I've been coming to Canada for years, and Canadians always tell me how politically to the right America is. May I take a moment and just thank you, now that we have Barack Obama, thank you for moving far ahead of us. And even on the pro-Israel level, it's more difficult in Canada today to say critical things of Israel than in the United States. So you're way ahead of us. And in fact, I've heard that there are people who want to make certain speech about Israel illegal in Canada. So, okay. Now, two things. Oh. It's the third book. I'm not going to go through all my books, but I'm just trying to illustrate. The first, Toward a Jewish Theology of Liberation, raises the question, has our power liberated us? Right? The question of liberation is contextual. Every Jewish generation has to ask that question. What is liberation for our generation? Obviously, in the Holocaust, it was to get out of that suffering, right? And to get some power, yes, to get some power. Now that we have power, the way we are using it is creating a new enslavement for us. I'm not even talking for the Palestinians, that's obvious. And the question we have to ask after the Holocaust, has our power liberated us from the trauma of the Holocaust, or has the use of our power to oppress another people deepened our trauma? So the Jews are more angry today than they were in the 1950s and 60s. It's not that anger was misplaced, but we seem to have dealt with it more humanely, more generously, seeing our suffering as a solidarity with others rather than a blunt instrument over against others. So, A Jewish Theology of Liberation asks whether power in and of itself liberates, or whether the abuse of power in our name has enslaved us. Judaism does not equal Israel is more about the subtitle that the publishers rejected, and that is the rebirth of the Jewish prophetic. Isn't it strange that a time after Auschwitz, when Jews are coming back, beginning to become empowered, maybe want to live off the fat of the land, that a group of Jewish prophets come and say, whoa, what are you doing with this power? But that goes way back to the Bible, right? When I've been talking about the prophetic, I know that a lot of people have questions about what that means, because especially in Canada, Canadians are so sophisticated, they don't read Bibles, like in Waco, Texas, where I live, where many of my students carry Bibles, including to my class. And when they get really angry at me, they sometimes refer to the Bible. It's okay, we can laugh in the church now. Yeah, it's a different place, but it's a place that's welcomed me. And in many ways understands me. The prophetic comes from the Bible. Remember that Jews, according to the story, were enslaved in Egypt. And God, Yahweh, came to the Jews, this lowly people of slaves, and said, hey, I'm here. I'm going to take you out. I'm going to liberate you. So this God is a God of liberation. And in the land, which in the Bible is promised to Israel, it's another question, but in the Bible it is, of course, they are supposed to do something with their newfound freedom, which is to create a new way of life. A way of life in a society unlike the society they came out of. But, of course, Israel doesn't do that. They begin to recreate it. And how do we know they recreate that society that they were liberated from? Because their widows and orphans and the poor and the stranger are abused. And the prophets come and say, look at the widow, the orphan, the poor, and the stranger. You are recreating Egypt. Don't come to God, the God of liberation, when you're using power to create havoc. Repent, come back to the way of God, which is to come back to the way of justice, or you will be exiled. Well, there it is, practicing in the way. So the prophets come to the people to say, you have strayed from what you're supposed to do, come back to it. If you don't, whoa. And if you read the Bible and you read the prophets, check out Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Amos, and Hosea. Nothing I say tonight comes close to their scorched earth policy. The prophets are way out there, way beyond what I would ever think of punishment or condemnation. But the message is clear. Don't come to God unless you do justice. If you don't do justice, you're finished as a people. And so today, we have that same dynamic in the Jewish community. We have the prophets coming to the community and saying, look what you're doing. You're squandering everything. The consequences are going to be great, by the way. I believe that the people Israel gave the prophetic to the world, but that were also the great strugglers against the prophetic. And so it is today. We have a civil war within the Jewish community over the question of justice. We have the prophets, and we have the establishment that's trying to kill the prophetic, and sometimes, once in a while, to kill one of the prophets. So, one of the consequences, and the great consequence of not doing justice, is exile. But of course, the prophets are exiled too by the normative community. And so in our time, there are many Jewish prophetic voices in exile from the Jewish community, and they are going to be in exile their entire life. So what does it mean to be Jewish? To argue for justice, as the prophets did, and be exiled by the powerful interests of the Jewish community. And that's what this book is about. It's titled Practicing Exile. How do we practice our justice and our faith and our spirituality and our connections with others from where we are in exile? Well, one of the ways, as I said, with the prophets is very concrete, right? The prophets say, I see the widow suffering, the orphan suffering, the poor suffering, the stranger suffering. It's always about something concrete. The prophets are not theoretical. I want to show you some signs of the prophetic today, concrete signs, of what is happening in Israel-Palestine, or basically within Palestine on the West Bank, and then show you some maps of what's happening, because by seeing concrete representations in maps, we can see where we are, not theoretically, but concretely, and then we know where we start from. Often in this civil war about what it means to be Jewish and the Jewish prophetic and Israel-Palestine, we yell at each other. But the maps aren't shown. So we go back and forth. Here I want to establish what is. Then we can ask, what do we do? So we start with defense. This fence, of course, is not the fence that I used to climb over to play baseball in the schoolyard, right? It's a fence that divides Palestinian territory, often villages from farmland. You can see it can go for miles. You see on both sides land is taken, trenches are built, and sensory equipment is throughout to advise Israeli soldiers if there's any movement in that area. The wall, also hundreds of yards, sometimes a mile or so of wall. There's another view of the fence. Olive trees being uprooted. Now, olive trees are for food, harvesting, income. They're also a sign of Palestinian steadfastness, right? So when olive trees are uprooted by Israel, it's about food and economy. It's about forcing people off the land. But it's also about humiliating the people. And of course, as we Jews know, in the Holocaust, it wasn't just the dead. We couldn't think about 6 million dead. We were humiliated as a people. The Nazis used to choose Jewish holidays to round up Jews. Used to round up Jews and put them in synagogues. They deliberately used Jewish symbols that were deep in Jewish life against us to humiliate us. So the olive tree is much like that. It's not just a form of income, which it is, or beauty, which it is. It's also a symbol of Palestinian life. Some of these trees are 400, 500, or 600 years old. Now here's one of the towers. I wasn't that sophisticated. I thought Israeli soldiers would be in them, but of course they have equipment in there to monitor what's going on, which tells the Israeli soldier elsewhere what to do. And of course it looks over the wall, and so you have these towers consistently throughout the wall to monitor what's happening within. This is a fence that protects a settlers-only road. There are roads in the West Bank where only Jews can ride, and this protects that road from Palestinians moving there, going there, throwing rocks onto there. This is Qalqilya in the north, a city, Palestinian city, completely surrounded by the wall. Of course, these images bring back memories for Jews, don't they? Now, this is Bethlehem, the use of language, again reminiscent of other periods of Jewish history, and in Hebrew, Arabic, and English, peace be with you. That's the wall around Bethlehem. So we ask the question, what is this wall? Israel calls it a security wall, but it's completely in the West Bank. We'll see the maps in a second. President Carter has referred to it as an apartheid wall, and we might refer to it as a ghetto wall. People ask me what's going to happen within these walls, and I tell them I don't know. But if you want to have a guess, a good guess, you should read histories of ghettos and find out what happens within those walls and to those walls as the people in them. And probably could have a pretty good prediction of what might happen, not making any predictions myself. Now we're going to look at some maps of Israel-Palestine, but primarily of the West Bank. But I want to start out with the first map, which shows you Israel in green, dark green. And the Palestinian state is supposed to be part of Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza with a connecting road. That's the international consensus of the solution of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. It's not complete justice for the Palestinians. The West Bank and Gaza is about 22% of historic Palestine, but that's the agreement. And that would at least give Jews and Palestinians a way of establishing a normal rhythm of life and see what happens after that. But as you're going to see in these maps, Israel is deep in the West Bank and is not going to be leaving. All of you remember Oslo in 1993, the time when peace was at hand. And here's a map of 1995 of the Oslo process as it was then. And as you can see, there are three areas. One, the dark brown, immediately went to the Palestinians. The lighter brown was jointly patrolled by Israel and the Palestinians, but would go back to the Palestinians, so you would have the dark and the light brown, and the white or gray would remain Israel. Now this is in the West Bank. And you can see on this map that Israel in the West Bank is on the borders, inside and around, and on the other side, right? The side bordering Israel, but also the side bordering Jordan. And if you look carefully, you can see triangles. And those little triangles, we'll see them in other maps, are settlements, which would grow. And those triangles are in blue, purple, So ultimately, the West Bank would be brown and purple. And Israel would be on both sides and inside of the Palestinians in the West Bank. This is 1997. Netanyahu, who has returned, if you've read the papers, he's back. And you can see that the darker gray is Palestine and the lighter gray is Israel in the West Bank, the borders, roads going through. You can see how Israel is all over on both sides and throughout the West Bank. May 2000, the dark brown is Palestine, the lighter brown is Israel, and the lighter brown, or almost white, is also Israel, with those triangles, which are settlements. It's going to be repetitive, and that's the lesson of the map. Barak's, quote, generous offers. If you look at the fourth quadrangle, you'll see what Barak ultimately offered the Palestinians. Palestine, white, Israel, in the West Bank. These are all more or less the same maps. Haba, which is supposedly the best map ever offered to the Palestinians, nobody knows why they rejected it. Well, if you look at this map, you might have a reason. Sharon on a good day in 2001, he was being generous. Look at that map he was offering. This is a map of the wall a few years ago by Gush Shalom, a Jewish Israeli group. And that's again in the West Bank. And you see again the wall is on both sides within the West Bank, right? And it's walling the Palestinians in. July 2006. April 2007. 2008. Oh, if you find 2009, send it to me. I haven't got mine yet. If I come back in 5 years, I can add those as well. This is a different map. Well, maybe different. This, where you see those dots, they're really villages, Palestinian villages and towns. Within what is today the accepted boundaries of Israel, that were destroyed in the creation of Israel when 750,000 to 800,000 Palestinians were expelled, or what we would say today, cleansed from the land. So this is a map where the dots are of what is Israel today, but that's really Palestine too, isn't it? And that's a map we don't see. None of these maps are shown. Or when they're shown, we don't understand them. Here we have, again, the map in the West Bank of the wall. So if we look at these two maps, these are maps of Jewish life that we don't talk about. Not only what's happening in the West Bank, but what happened in the creation of Israel. And there are some Jews, Jewish Israelis, who believe what's happening in the West Bank is just a continuity of what happened in the creation of Israel, because Jewish population centers were on the coast of what became Israel. Parts of that, but also the interior, were empty to Palestinians. Jews then settled there. Now Palestinians are being driven further toward the Jordan, and Jews are settling there. What you have left are Palestinian population centers that had too many Palestinians to take, surrounded by Israeli settlements, which is what happened in the creation of the State of Israel. Now, the Holocaust also is a map of Jewish life. Yes, very deeply so. So these are three maps. We talk almost endlessly about the Holocaust now. But we don't talk about 1948. And when we talk about the West Bank, we don't show the maps. We just say that the Palestinians can't really say yes to the freedom that they're being